Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Sean Dugan of the Alaska Dispatch, and Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Paul, EPA Administrator Gina McCarty visits Southwest Alaska to hear about the proposed Pebble Mine. She got an earful.
She did. In Dillingham, I guess a community of about 2,300, residents packed the high school, and pretty much all she heard was negative comments about Pebble. Nobody supported it. It would wipe out fishing. They were afraid it would destroy their culture. A lot of opposition in that part of the country to Pebble Prospect being developed. When she went to Iliamna, she did hear positive people who wanted jobs, that they needed jobs, they needed a future. So she got a lot of that in Iliamna, although there was still opposition there as well. So when she went to Southwest Alaska, I think you can, at one point, one of the news accounts said she spoke to no one in Dillingham that was for it while she was there, which I thought was kind of amazing. But I think overall she must have come away from that pretty well amazed at the opposition to the project.
Well, although she said in one of the stories I saw that I'm not taking numbers here of who's for and who's against. I'm just trying to get people's perspective and hear from different kinds of people.
Well, I don't know what else she could say.
Okay, let's go to Dermot Cole. Once again, she did say she was here to listen. She said the Obama administration's decision about whether the mine should go forward or not will be based on reason and sound science. But isn't this kind of what we hear from every administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican? Nobody comes forward and says, I'm going to base my decision on bad science and unreasonable material.
Well, I think in a way to reiterate what Paul just said, yeah, she has to say that, and people will always come back with that line. I think hearing overwhelmingly negative testimony is going to have an impact on her, however, because it's something that'll be memorable. She may not be counting votes or counting heads, but that overall presentation will impact the way that at least she deals with this in the future. Of course, it's not all being decided by a simple trip to Alaska. There's a complicated political situation here regarding EPA's role and whether or not it's overstepping its boundaries, which, you know, the supporters of this exploration project would are quick to argue that that's what's going on. But there's a long way to go about this, but you'd say that for the opponents of the project, it's probably a good visit.
Okay, and when you say there's a long way to go, can you flesh that out a little bit for us to give us a better understanding of what needs to be done?
Well, the opponents of the project want EPA basically to declare that this is not going to go forward. The supporters will say, well, look, they haven't filed their permits yet, and you should allow that process to proceed, and then judge the application based on its merits. I'm not in the prediction business here, but this is a long, difficult process ahead for the supporters of this project. And I'd say that bureaucratically, it's sort of leaning against them right now.
One thing, Dermot, is the political dimension. I guess whether the decision is political or it's based on the soundest of science, it's really hard to believe that the Obama administration would say no to the Pebble Mine between now and the election. That would put Democrat Mark Begich in a lot of trouble. Can you hear me out there, Doc?
Yeah, I think it'll be dragged out much longer than that. I think this is a long process. This is not months. This is years.
Okay, and it conceivably, in that case, it could go years beyond the Obama administration, which has 3 years to run. Sean, a sudden plane crash in Anchorage's Merrill Field brings death to two young Alaskans. You wrote about the couple and the tragedy. What happened?
Yeah, it was last Saturday, a young couple that liked to fly, the male half, Robert Lilly, was a commercial pilot, had just secured a job for himself in Homer, I believe. They've been out for a quick little flight, flying from Wasilla to land at Merrill Field in the middle of Anchorage. As they were coming in for a landing, the air traffic control tower told them to abort the landing and go around for another landing because there was a plane in the taxiway. Witnesses say the plane, as it turned and to bank to go around, stalled and then came down nose first onto the grass near the runway. People got there within about 90 seconds, but they were unable to save the couple, Rob Lilly and Jesse Nelson. You know, it's just another tragedy of the both the beauty and the beast of Alaska. You know, we get to enjoy these beautiful vistas and this great land, but it can be dangerous. And this is just another example of that. Just yesterday, two more guys from Palmer were killed in a plane crash near Sutton. So now I think
on the front page of the Daily News today, if I might, is a plane crash out in McGrath. This time the pilot walked away, literally walked away.
Yeah,
so another one of those.
He was a flight instructor and he did what you're supposed to do when a plane stalls, and that is, kind of let it. You're supposed to let the nose kind of come down and fight the urge to pull back on the stick, which of course causes you to stall out and then come down. But you know, we've had 26 deaths this year. That is above average. But then you have to remember that the one plane crash down there on the Kenai Peninsula, I think, took the lives of 10 people.
So that the number, tourists who were going out to a lodge.
Yes, two families and the pilot there. So that number's kind of inflated. You know, there's not any one cause. I would say, however, though, that the most dangerous months typically for Alaska small plane pilots are upcoming, the months of September and October. Hunting season starts. There's a lot more small planes going to and from remote areas in more marginal and weather conditions. So I hope we've seen the end of this. Unfortunately, there'll probably be a few more incidents. You know, interestingly enough, the only pattern I can find with incidents in the state is maritime. There seems to have been a lot of maritime incidents, especially with fishing vessels running aground. The U.S. Coast Guard says that so far this year, six fishing captains in Prince William Sound have run aground after falling asleep at the helm. So I don't know if that's related to the number of fish. There was a record number of pinks out there for them to get. Are they overfishing or what? But I mean, that's really the only transportation related trend I could find.
The young pilot who died at Merrill Field was a trained pilot and had some experience, but do we know how many hours he had?
No, and all that will come out with the NTSB. He had a lot of training. You know, he had single engine for any of you pilots out there. He also had multi-engine commercial pilots, instrument
pilots.
He
was licensed for that?
Yes, and so that does take quite a little bit of training. His family says he flew quite a bit. The couple loved to fly, and you know, the NTSB will eventually come out with the cause of that.
Okay, let's go to Paul Jenkins. Paul, the members of the Anchorage Teachers Union ratify a three-year contract. If the school board approves the deal, we will have labor peace, at least where the teachers are concerned. What's the agreement and how did they reach it?
Well, the school board will have to ratify this or vote on September 9th, I guess. What they've done is they've taken a 1% raise on the first, second, and third year of the contract, a three-year contract. There's a $1,500 bonus in the first and third years, which actually boosts them up to about a 3% raise in those 2 years. They've cut anybody who makes who's working less than 50% of the time will lose health care benefits, but the health care benefits go $1,465 a month in the first year and over $1,500 a month in the second and third year. I think they got where they are because the economy is not what it should be. They're not sure what the legislature is likely to do with health care. This is a fairly generous health care package. And a 3% raise, despite them calling it a 1% raise, in this economy, I think you would be hard to find during a three-year contract at a private company.
So speaking of hard, I guess it's hard to believe that the school board would turn this down at this point, right?
I think they don't need the grief. Yeah, this is the way everybody comes out of this happy. On paper, it looks pretty, oh, we've only got a 1% raise. So I think that they would probably, and the school board president has already said that the administration pretty much followed the directions and guidelines from the school board. So I think the school board's going to get what it wants to. So I imagine they would approve it.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Dermot Cole, and Sean Dugan. Dermot, the Hollywood movie On Frozen Ground is on thin ice when it comes to the state's generous film credit program. You have not only been following the making of the film, but you and our colleague Sean Dugan saw it while it was being streamed. So maybe we should start off with the movie review and then go to the economics.
Okay, I'd give it a mixed review, let's put it that way, Mike. I watched it online Thursday night, and I think it's, I agree with the critics that have said it's, you know, similar to an episode of Law & Order or CSI. It's not, I don't believe it's a great movie, but I do believe that it's, you know, typical Hollywood crime drama. It presents Anchorage in a pretty gray light. I think in watching the whole thing, I think the sun was shining for about, you know, 15 seconds in the entire film. So it's a grim story. You know, the mass murderer, Alaska's most notorious mass murderer.
Robert Hansen, the baker.
Right. Yes. And he, I think the actors did a pretty good job. I enjoyed it. I think the script was weak in the sense of it was maybe a little unfocused. And I don't know, Sean may have some views on this, but it may have been deliberately unfocused because they didn't want to deal with the play up the murderer or play up the investigation too much. They wanted to bring the victims more into the scene, and that may have helped the sort of get support for the project, but I don't think it helped the end result.
Let's do a little bit of the economics. Tell us about the film credit. First of all, what is that designed to do, and how long have we had it, and what is it doing?
Okay, well, this film, this is the second major production that's actually reached the screen with the Alaska Film Credit Program. Almost every state in the country has some effort underway to try to attract Hollywood or TV shows to their states. In our case, the Frozen Ground producers collected tax credits of more than $6 million for this production. Now, what happens here, the companies form LLCs, and they don't pay state corporate income tax on that. So the transferable tax credit, in essence, becomes a saleable commodity.
Transferable.
Transferable. Basically, it's sold to a company that does have a tax burden. So it's worth somewhat less than $6.3 million that they collected for this subsidy. I mean, so we don't know who's going to end up exactly with that credit, but the makers of this film, it does help their finances to a considerable degree. They, you know, and there has to be an economic analysis at some point that's fair and reasonable. The company paid in salaries to Alaskans a little over $1 million. They spent several million dollars on services, but again, they collected a subsidy worth $6 million.
And we'll never get a complete balance sheet. Is that correct? That you can put what their, you know, tax credit is on one side and what they spent on the other. It just never gets that clear, is my understanding, right?
Right. At least in my analysis, it has not been that clear, because in Alaska production expenses, they include the money paid to, you know, Nicolas Cage and John Cusack. So that's not really an Alaska production expense as far as I'm concerned. Although it shows up that way.
Okay. Sean, you saw the film too, and you've been thinking about it. Tell us some of your response and perhaps some comment on what you heard from Dermot.
Well, I would agree with Dermot. I think I give it a solid B minus. I think it's, you know, your standard crime drama fare. It does have a little more focus, as he said, on some of the victims. And while that may have helped the film producers, you know, get cooperation from some of the original participants in the case, including Glenn Flothy, the state trooper who Jack Holcomb, is the main character Nicolas Cage plays, is based on. I think it kind of scatters the movie. There are a lot of script holes. It's just not, you know, a memorable. It's not like a genre-defining movie by any means. It's kind of grim and doomy in ways. There is a scene.
Well, it is about a mass murderer.
It is, but it's very, and we were talking about this, it's very like Blade Runner, that science fiction movie from the 80s. It's always raining. It's always dark and gray. Everybody's wearing dark clothes. Nobody looks very healthy particularly. It just makes Anchorage look like a really bad place to be in the 80s. And, you know, maybe it could be argued that that part of town was a bad place to be in the 80s.
But, Mike, can I add?
Yeah, Dermot.
Well, it certainly doesn't help the Wild About Anchorage, you know, campaign. And we might want to mention that I was surprised that, you know, Pat Dugan's name came up in this film.
The distinguished father of our distinguished guest.
Yeah. Yeah, he was good friends with Glenn Filothy back from when they both worked at the Fairbanks prosecutor's office. And I was in high school, I believe, when he flew down over a weekend to write up a search warrant. Interestingly enough, that became the first search warrant in the U.S. that was written solely on FBI profiling evidence to actually be successful. So they still talk about that. But, you know, he had a minor part. And I guess when they shot it, guys shuffling papers across a desk wasn't that exciting. So they just decided to use his name.
Okay, Paul Jenkins, let's get you in here because you covered the real Robert Hansen and the real murders and the real events, or at least you covered part of what happened.
Yeah.
Tell us some of your experiences, some of your reflections on that time and Hansen and what you saw.
Well, first, Anchorage was quite different than it is now, and there were parts of it that were pretty grim and fairly seedy, at least in the middle of the night. As this thing unfolded, I mean, I came across the story just on, I think, a routine police check. I worked for the Associated Press at the time, and we broke the story. But as it unfolded, it was just, you know, I've come from the South. I've come from outside where there was major crimes all the time. This was really horrific. It was head and shoulders above anything I'd ever been involved in before. And it was, frankly, frightening. This guy, it was weird because it's such a small town. I used to pick up donuts at his donut shop on the way to work in the morning.
Bob the Baker.
Yeah, he had a donut shop, and we used to pick up donuts there all the time. It was just bizarre. You know, I mean, it was hard to get your mind around.
Okay. Sean Dugan, you're not the old sourdough, you're the young sourdough.
Thank you.
So we're going to ask you in that tradition, the Alaska State Fair brings three things to mind: food booths, former rock stars making renewed appearances here, and giant vegetables. This year's star giant vegetable is a pumpkin weighing almost 1,200 pounds.
Yeah.
Why do Alaskans, fairgoers, newspapers, readers, television reporters find giant vegetables irresistible?
Well, you know, I think it's just something that sets Alaska apart from the rest of the country, that we have all this daylight and we can grow these monstrous vegetables. And of course, Alaskans like nothing more than being set apart, made special in comparison to the rest.
It's like having Mount McKinley.
Exactly. We've got the biggest mountain. We've got the biggest state. Oh, by the way, we've got the biggest vegetables. And it's kind of neat for kids especially to go up and, you know, you stand next to a 1,200-pound pumpkin. And frankly, pumpkins are newcomers to the big veggie game here at the state fair. They've only been, I think, submitted for the last 8 or 9 years. It's always been the cabbage has been the star of the show. But I just think it's something that maybe Alaskans can hang their hat on and say, look, you know, we're better than the rest of you. I mean, that's the way it makes
visuals if you're in the television business. There's no question about that. Here it is. Here's the giant whatever it is.
Yeah, a giant pumpkin like that can eat 500 gallons of water a day. I mean, they're massive, massive things.
I'm sort of surprised these giant vegetables don't become extras in horror movies. Paul, as you know, there are national rankings for just about everything. The qualities of schools, the quality of air, tax burdens, you name it. Now Allstate, the insurance giant, has America's Best Drivers Report. And somehow, we're not near the top of this.
We're 132nd out of 200 large cities. And I think it was rigged. Because there's no way we should be that high.
I agree.
coming to work this morning, I thought, because people ran red lights in front of me two times. I mean, this is a short strip of highway.
Paul, the major insurance firms tells us this is based on the actuarial reports, I assume.
Exactly. And in Anchorage, you can expect to be in a crash, according to their numbers, every 8.7 years. The worst place to drive in the country, apparently, is Washington, D.C., which I think we could make several.
There's a metaphor in there somewhere.
I know. Yeah. I know there is. But we're 132nd. Fort Collins, Colorado is the best place.
And how do what is there about the people of, are they just law-abiding citizens there?
They're,
or what?
There's better drivers. I'm not sure. But there's no way. At 132, if that's accurate, I can't. First off, this is a neat way for Allstate to get a lot of publicity in 132 or 200 cities. But it's interesting that we score so low, and yet we have We have fairly decent traffic enforcement here, I would think, but it's we apparently like to run into things. So
file insurance claims.
So drive like your life depends on it, because it really does.
Okay, let's talk about some changes here for a little bit. Sean, changes are coming at the Alaska Dispatch, your current employer, after years in television. Tell us what's ahead for the Dispatch, and then we'll go to Dermot Cole, who has something to do with that too.
Well, yeah, the Alaska Dispatch is expanding. You know, it began 5 years ago. I worked there for the summer on a temporary contract. I've taken a full-time job there. They're trying to get, they want to be the main news source for the state of Alaska, and they're putting a lot of resources into that. We've hired Casey Grove from the Anchorage Daily News will be starting there. We've hired a web editor from Channel 11. We've got a video journalist on the way from New York as well. So the management there's making a real commitment to try and expand and grow our readership. And frankly, I'm really excited. It's in a way, there's a little media war brewing. It's like everybody's building battleships. I'm kind of interested to see how.
And then
it
we're
going to
have Channel 2 and Channel 11 in a television war, as well as the print or electronic war, something like that. I guess you're still in the electronic world.
Well, and those worlds are merging, frankly, Mike. You know, the print and broadcast journalism worlds are kind of merging into some other thing. We're not sure what that is yet. But, you know, we've got a lot of seasoned reporters there and some really energetic youth, and I'm excited to see how things
and
go.
And you're staying at the Dispatch after some interim for the summer. What are your assignments going to be? You are a what kind of reporter? General assignment or
yes,
municipal?
I do a lot of general assignment, mostly statewide news. I'll be covering politics, resource development, you know, the things I've been plucking away at for the last 10 or 12 years.
Okay, and occasionally the movies. Dermot Cole, after more than 35 years at the Newsminer and multiple roles as reporter, editor, columnist, voice of the community, you were saying goodbye to the great Fairbanks newspaper. You become a columnist, reporter for the Alaska Dispatch. Give us some of your reflections on leaving your home flagship paper after quite a while.
Well, that's right, Mike. I have been here a long time, more than 35 years, and I am excited about going to the Alaska Dispatch. It'll be a change for me, a new challenge. And I'm really impressed with the people that work there, and it's hard in a way to leave the Newsminer. I've done a lot of different things here over these decades. It's and I, you know, exclusively focus on Fairbanks. I think in the future I'm going to maybe continue to be based in Fairbanks, but maybe a bit more of a statewide perspective if I can. Part of this comes from, you know, I just the desire to try something new. I've been at the Newsminer for a long time and written a daily column, and it's been very enjoyable. And it's really hard to sum up.
Well, one of the things wonderful in your years at the Newsminer, you've become quite knowledgeable, if not expert, on one thing in particular. That is the history of the Newsminer. Particularly publisher W.F. Thompson of yesteryear.
That's true. You know, I was reflecting on this, Mike, as I prepared to leave. The W.F. Thompson was the first publisher of the Newsminer during the Gold Rush era, and he turned 60 in 1923. And I'm going to turn 60 next month. So, you know, I quoted him in one of my farewell columns here, and then he also turned 60 in 1925. Apparently, in 1925, he had forgotten that he had already turned 60 in 1923. So he wrote another column in 1925 about turning 60. So maybe in a couple of years, I'll, you know, be able to do it again. Actually, I think it is, you know, being 60 in 1925 or 1923 is a lot older than it is today, apparently.
And how different were those two columns? Or were they weren't the same, were they?
Let's put it this way. They were similar. And those of us who have been around, written for a long time, do find ourselves repeating certain phrases or comments from time to time. And I think Thompson just forgot in 1925 that he had already celebrated this occasion 2 years earlier. I hope it doesn't happen to me too often.
Okay. Paul, this week, Americans all over the country and here in Alaska celebrated the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Neither you or I were adults at that time, but we were old enough to remember the America of 1963. your reflections, and as your colleague and member of your age group, I'll share a few myself.
Well, it was a in 63. I was in high school. It was a vastly different, tumultuous time. I remember when the first black girl was escorted to our high school with three carloads of U.S. Marshals.
And that was where?
And that was Edgewater High School in Orlando, Florida. It was a time of great change. I remember this speech. I remember hearing it and thinking, this is, it was a soul-stirring speech. It was very, very impressive. The idea and the thought behind it, and it had a vast effect, I think, on relations in this country, and civil rights in the movement.
Had an effect on newspapers, because newspapers were much more the source of information than they are today.
Very true.
And we're out of time, and we can't be more of information to you today. But we will see you next week right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.